Education for Monday, May 21st, 2007. Welcome all. We have three bills on our agenda this afternoon. We're going to jump around a lot to try to accommodate some schedules. We will start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 462A. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 462A requires the Superintendent of Public Instruction to issue a fact-finding report on the division of the South Umpqua School District No. 19 into two districts. Provides for the selection and duties of a fact finder, requires a report to order district boundary board to submit question of dividing district to school district electors, to recommend conversion of Canyonville School to public charter school, or to consider an alternative for the operation of the Canyonville School. Requires the district boundary board to proceed with the division if the majority of votes cast in the election approve, declares an emergency, and takes effect on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Senator Cruz, welcome to the House Education Committee.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Mr. Olson did a pretty decent job of describing what the bill does, and so I'll just kind of give you a little bit of background. This bill came, it was a bill I filed early in session. The original bill called for basically the splitting of the South Umpqua School District into two districts, but after further review of the case and conversations with a whole lot of folks here in the building, we weren't sure that that was something that was going to be viable in the process and get through. And so what we came down to, and also in looking at state law, there's provisions in state law to combine school districts, but there is no provisions in state law to separate school districts. And it's not that I'm necessarily advocating for more school districts necessarily, but we need to have accommodations in those rare situations where it may make some sense for a lot of reasons to consider making two school districts out of one. And clearly this is one of those cases. We have reached an impasse in Southern Douglas County at this point in time between the South Umpqua School District and the city of Canyonville. Now, if you really want to go back in history, in 1964, three small school districts in Southern Douglas County combined into one. That was Tri-City, Myrtle Creek, and Canyonville. And the accommodation worked relatively well up until just a few years ago when the decision was made by the South Umpqua District to close the middle school in Canyonville, and which I would say, to put it mildly, upset the citizens of Canyonville, which is understandable because in small rural communities, the school is a huge part of their identity and their ability to keep their schools and keep their kids in their communities, I think is relatively important. The situation has not worked out the way the South Umpqua District envisioned as far as the money they would save. In fact, I think the move has probably ended up costing them money. One of the results of this was that the South Umpqua District went for a bond levy to build new buildings, and it was soundly defeated. And we know historically that bond measures are tough enough to pass if the entire community is supportive. If you've got a major segment of the community that's going to vote against anything you attempt because you have upset them, it sets up a scenario where nothing is going to get accomplished. And clearly that is the point we have reached in this community and my district. And so after all the conversations we had here in the building as to the appropriate approach to take, the decision was made that we would set up a process, basically a template, for getting appropriate finding of fact and making the determination as to whether the separation was viable, so we would know impacts both on the existing district and the new district as far as, because we don't want to put either in jeopardy if indeed we do a separation. We want them both to be viable and be vibrant schools. And And in my opinion, I think we set up a very good process to do that fact-finding through independent, bringing somebody independent in to do the assessment. And at the end of the day, if it is found that a separation is viable and doable, putting it to the vote of the people to see if indeed that's what they would support. There were some issues with the folks involved as to the timelines that we put in the bill. I think they're appropriate timelines, but I also said that if indeed the timelines get too compressed or are too broad as we go through the process, we would have the ability in February to come back and adjust some of those things. But but our intent with this bill is, one, to hopefully get the appropriate finding of facts and the resolution of the issues in the South Umpqua School District, and two, to set up in statute a process by which if the situation arises again in another part of the state, we have a process to go through for them to make their determination as well.
Thank you, Senator. Members' questions. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the idea of coming and just doing a fact-finding mission, because I think that's what we really need to do. You know, we passed a bill earlier in this session from this bill that Representative Dollum about small and essential schools that are out there, and, you know, let's look at them for the next year and see can we afford to even have them exist, because they are at peril right now with our formula and so on. And so I am concerned that we're going to find those things. It doesn't solve the problem for them. I think the finding might find out that they couldn't exist alone because there won't be enough money. But I also think, and I guess I'm just, this is the question, what we're finding is that the formula, regardless of whether we like it the way it is or not, it really doesn't have a at its core is not that every kid will get a basic education, because some of these districts that are getting smaller are finding themselves unable to provide the basic education with the way it's set up. And so if the state ever goes to an idea where we're going to give a base level, these might be more sustainable, but they may cost more for the state to run. So in your opinion, I guess, if the fact-finding comes out in the sense that monetarily it can't survive either one of them, do you think that's going to be helpful to these people, or is it just the emotional part of the schools?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, I think when the facts are on the table, I think reasonable people will accept the facts, and I'm not going to prejudge what that fact base will be, and we will see how it comes out. But I think part of the problem at this point in time is that all parties have not felt that they've had their due day in court, and we want to make sure that all parties have the full opportunity to weigh in on what they think is appropriate, and if for the folks in Canyonville who truly believe that they can support a K-12 system, let them prove their case. And if they can, fine. If they can't, we'll make other accommodations, which is why we have other things in the bill. For example, if it's proven that they can't, but they wanted to keep their middle school, having the ability to go charter with K-8 would be a viable option for them at that point as well. So, so we tried to leave all the options on the table as far as any sort of arrangement that could be made. But your bigger point, I absolutely agree with, and we're going to be looking going into this interim at how we do some merging, especially in the rural parts of the state, of some administrative functions and getting to a point where school districts can have shared services. So, I mean, I think that's going to be critical to make sure that all kids do have access to the full broad range of education opportunities. So it's we're viewing that. Senator Walker and I have had a lot of conversations about that. I was talking to Vice Chair Comp and Chair Buckley before we kicked this off, saying that we're going to be very intense in our discussions with the department and as we move into the interim on these issues. So it's critical that we put a lot of effort into that in the next year.
Thank you, Senator. Members, just so you know, there are folks here to testify on this bill. If you have something specific for the Senator, I'd be glad to entertain a question. Vice Chair Kahn.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Senator, just real quickly, I'm not familiar with the your Senate district. This is from your Senate district?
Yes.
And who are your representatives? Because frequently people from your district are going to be getting a whole lot more emails than I would.
Right.
So I was just wondering, like, who your representatives
Chair Buckley, Vice Chair Comp, the representative for this school district is Representative Morgan.
Morgan, okay, thank you.
And she would have been here today to testify, but she is, I think, still in British Columbia, I think.
She did contact me and with her support of this.
Okay, yeah. That's what I wanted to know.
Visiting with her mommy.
Yes, yes.
Thank you,
Senator. Thank you for bringing this forward. I know it's a very tough issue. I appreciate all the work you've done on it, and we'll let you go back to your work. And we will, for the folks here to testify on this bill, we'll come back to this bill in about 15 minutes. We have a couple of other people we need to testify on a couple other bills.
Mr. Chair, thank you for accommodating me and for hearing this bill. I think it's an important bill, not only to the folks in my district, but big picture probably for the folks in the state. There are some other parts of the state where there are similar issues. I know Toledo is one, and this may put down a roadmap for them to solve their problems, which are slightly more complicated, I believe.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 462A. Okay. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 951A. And Mr. Olson, if you'd be so kind, and Secretary of State Bradbury, if you'd join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 951A directs community colleges and state institutions of higher education to adopt plans to encourage students to register to vote and to vote in elections. It requires that students receive information about activities related to voting that are prohibited by law and penalties for those activities. It declares an emergency and takes effect July 1st, 2007. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Welcome.
Welcome. For the record, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State. Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, I think all of you know I serve as the Chief Elections Officer for the state of Oregon, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill because one of the things that really makes our election system work is to increase the number of people who are participating in it. And I have worked with the Oregon Student Association for years to appear at campuses and increase voter or increase student participation in the electoral process. And it's just real clear to me that, you know, when you're in college and you're registering for courses, it's just not at the top of your list to think about registering or re-registering to vote, because as we all know, when you're in college, you might change your address once a quarter. And so it's really a challenge to keep people plugged into the electoral system and thereby help them develop the habit of voting, which is something we want them to carry with them. I think it's important to emphasize that there is a very large potential voter pool in our university and community college system. It's estimated there are about 400,000 people, some of whom obviously are registered, some of whom aren't. And so it's a critical part of the whole system. I just want to tell you one story. I worked with the Oregon Student Association and actually worked with the university presidents to assist with voter registration. And it was really great because a number of the university presidents took the pledge, so to speak, to really work with the students and help people get registered. And one example, there are meetings in dorms at the beginning of each quarter, and all the residents of that dorm or that section of the dorm come to the meeting. And the Oregon Student Association wanted to be able to send a representative to that meeting and spend 4 minutes talking about registering to vote and offering people the opportunity to register. And initially, the housing folks at the university said no. And then, thanks to the pledge that the presidents took, and that all changed, and they started to work with the students and had the OSA come in. This bill, I think, is really a way to say, yeah, we want that to happen, we want that to continue to happen, and we want you to do what you can as a university or a community college to get people registered to vote. So I'm just here to say I think it's a great idea and hope we can move forward on it.
Thank you so much. Members, any questions? President Clem.
We're going back to the other bill, and then we'll have more testimony on this.
We'll have more testimony on this bill later on this afternoon.
Just one question.
Representative Clem.
For the Secretary of State, since he's here. Now, do we know how it's your relationship to the counties would sort of work on Dropbox locations? Because that was always a big thing. Could we get a Dropbox location, or, you know, back when I was in college, could we get a voting station on campus? And is that something you can help with, or in the universities, could they help with it really, or is it really a county function?
That is a decision that is made by each of the county clerks. I have certainly indicated my strong support for there being drop boxes on the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, Southern Oregon University, all the university campuses. But that is a decision that has to be made by each county clerk.
So if I might follow up, this bill calls for a plan to be created. The plan might be that they all go to talk to their clerk and you know, make a pitch or talk to the commissioners or something to try and get something going.
Right. That could certainly be part of it.
All right, then.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions?
Yeah.
Representative Greenman.
Why does it have to be a decision by the county clerk? Why can't we in statute require that they have an official
I vote think
receiver?
You could. You are the lawmaker.
But right now, it's up to the county clerk.
Right, and I'm not a lawmaker, so it's up to you.
Used to be.
But it's very important, Representative Greenlick, to separate the two.
Any further questions for the Secretary of State? Seeing none, thank you very
so
much, Mr. Bradley.
Real pleasure to be here.
I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 951. We will be coming back to that later this afternoon. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 365. Mr. Wilson, if you'd be so kind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 365A requires college textbook publishers to provide prospective adopters of a particular textbook or set of textbooks with specified information regarding products, requires a publisher that sells textbook bundles to offer higher education institutions the option of ordering each component of the bundle separately and disclose availability and pricing of separately purchased textbooks. You have before you, committee members, an A5 amendment, which would do the following. It would delete all the whereas clauses. It would refine the definition of textbook bundle, add to the definition of what a textbook bundle does not include, focus the list of textbooks, including supplemental items, to be provided to a subject being taught in a course, delete language regarding the length of time the publisher plans to keep the product on the market, replace it with language regarding the year the prior edition of the textbook was published, delete wholesale price and replace it with the price the publisher would offer the textbook or components of the textbook bundle to higher education institutions. Add the option of making the list of textbooks, including supplemental items, available by phone, mail, or email. And would clarify that the option of ordering each component of the textbook bundle separately also applies to potential adopters of the textbooks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Welcome. Hello, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me jump up to the front, because I have to drive back to Monmouth and teach. I'm Mark Perlman. I'm a philosophy professor at Western Oregon University, and I'm here in support of the bill, and just wanted to say a few things about it as a professor, as somebody who is an adopter. You all know that textbooks are getting to be more and more a significant part of the costs of college education, and one of the things that I guess Oregon has us, because the state universities anyway are on terms instead of semesters, that means that they buy books three times a year, or in the summer four, so that's an extra round of book buying that you have in this system. So it can be $400 or $500 a term to buy books for your courses. And I found just recently with Amazon.com and all these online sources that some students who are clever and will, instead of going to the bookstore, they'll fire up one of the websites and try and find a cheaper copy of the book. But the problem is that then it takes them 2 weeks to get the book, so they spend the first 2 weeks of the term without a book. So I'm not too thrilled with that strategy, but I certainly sympathize with their need to find the books as cheaply as they can. And when I'm choosing a textbook, I've often been in the position, I get literature from all kinds of companies. Now, when you go and buy the latest book from Tom Clancy, Thriller, or whatever, you look on the back of the book, and it's printed on the book, $6.99, whatever the price is. Textbooks, you will never find a textbook that has the price printed on the book.
No.
You won't find the literature that they send professors advertising how wonderful this new book is. You'll never find the price on that either. You go to the website, you won't find the price there either. I mean, it could take me a half an hour of digging and searching to try and find out how much is this book actually going to cost. And one thing with textbook prices, it's becoming increasingly important that I take that into account. And if I have a choice between three books that are roughly the same quality and material, one of them's $30, one of them's $60, and one of them's $90, I'm likely to pick the cheaper book for my students so they can save them some money. But I can only do that if I know what it is. In a sense, I'm happy to have, to let the market work. Prices are artificially high, partly because if you don't have the information, then you can't pick on the basis of the cost of the book. Now, you might have noticed I brought some visual aids with me. Two of the things that we're really concerned about and that this bill would deal with are two things that are a problem for price. One of them is the frequency of new editions. You know, you'll find a book, it'll be brand new, you'll have to buy all new copies, and then used copies get into the system, and eventually you can find many used copies which are cost less. And the publishers, having figured that out, will bring out another edition. And I brought one example. I didn't bring all the copies of this that I have, by the way. These are all the same book. This is the fourth edition, and I have a sort of a fondness for this because when I was an undergraduate in 1982, this was my first philosophy book ever. This was already the fourth edition. I've taught out of the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th editions, and look at how beautiful the other covers are. But as far as what's in these books, they're almost identical. They sometimes will move around sections so that they're in a different order, or they'll throw in one new article. But, you know, it's the new editions is almost exclusively intended to make everyone have to buy brand new books and to make all those old copies obsolete. And I can't even order them. The bookstore won't let me use an old edition because they can't be assured that they can find enough copies of it around, so I'm stuck. I have to use the new edition, and sometimes I order the edition, they don't bother to tell me, and so day one of the term comes up, and I'm the only one that doesn't have the book. But that's one problem, and obviously we can't just say no more new editions, but what we can do is at least require people to publishers to make information available. How many editions have there been? How frequently have they been changing over? I mean, it's not an absolute predictor, but, you know, if it's every 2-3 years, you know how long these new books are going to last. So that's one aspect of this bill that would at least let us know what the situation is with a particular publisher. And if it's every 2 or 3 years a new edition, then maybe I'm not going to be looking so favorable on that publisher. The other problematic issue is bundling. This is a logic book that's got bundled, I think it's a CD-ROM of exercises and additional material. And I can't buy the book without the CD-ROM. It comes like this, and that's the way it comes. This one is bundled with an access to a website. And what's interesting is all these things, when they give you an access to a website, the access only lasts as long as the term. The book may be something you could keep for a long time, but that other thing that you bought to go along with the book, now, maybe I'm fooling myself if I think that my logic students are going to keep doing logic after the term is over, but at least it seems odd to me that you know, this is part of a product, a book they could keep forever, their access to the additional material, which they spent more for and which they couldn't buy it without that additional component. It expires when the end of the term. So if I had my choice, oh, here's another one. This is one where they give you a workbook or some kind of book funneled in, and you can't buy the big one without the small one. And if I don't want the small one, for many publishers, there's no way that you can pick and choose. Now, some publishers, they will let you pick exactly what you want. And what this bill would require is that other publishers follow that same process, so that if I'm deciding what book I want, I can use only the material I want, and I don't have to have my students buy things that they don't need. And so, you know, this bill doesn't solve all of our problems with textbooks by any means, but it makes a few little moves in that direction. And so as a professor who makes these decisions, but also as somebody who cares about the students, and I want them to be able to stay in school and to manage their textbook budget as well as they can, I would urge that the committee pass this bill. And I'm looking at the amendments. As far as I can tell, I would favor the amended version. It seems mostly that it's streamlined in a couple of minor changes. So I would recommend, I guess it's 365A5 to all of you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. How much time do we have? When do you have to get in the car? You okay for a couple minutes?
You have a couple minutes.
Representative Dolan.
Do you know if other states have unbundled, so to speak? Would Oregon be one of the first, or where would we be on this?
Actually, I'm not sure about that. I think maybe the folks from the Oregon Student Association might know that better than I do.
Vice Chair Cobb.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Just a similar thought here from Representative Dolan, and maybe I missed it in the bill. Are we trying to set something in statute that is going to control textbook providers?
Well, it's going to require them to make information available to the people that are making the decisions, information about the price of the book, information about the frequency of editions. And the only other thing would be to require that they allow things to be sold unbundled.
Right. Follow up.
Vice Chair?
I'm just curious how in the world you'd ever do that, period, because I don't know of any textbook company in Oregon. Almost all textbook companies are in Texas, California. I like what you're saying, but I have it just eludes me how we would enforce this.
Professor, if you don't have an answer, there will be folks afterwards who will.
Well, I imagine if they want to sell textbooks to the, you know, many thousands of customers, that they'll have to abide by Oregon's law.
Well, just the only comment, as being an educator in the K-12 system, people don't have a whole lot of respect for little old Oregon when it comes to textbooks.
I guess I can say
there's just a bigger market.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beale.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment, Mr. Chair, that you gave as an example $30, $60, and $90, but the fact is, you're remembering the old days.
Yeah.
I mean, my...
You're right.
I've got two grandkids in college. They pay $250 and $300 a book nowadays. I mean, it's just really unbelievable.
Not in my class, they don't.
Books I hope not. But, they're spending about $1,000 a term on textbooks now. It's just absolutely appalling.
Just a further follow-up, because I really do applaud what you're trying to do. As somebody that has lived in poverty two-thirds of my life, when I went to college, I did not ever buy a new textbook. And then I've been buying them online, as you said, and missed the first week to 10 days of class time to get a much more reasonable price through just the open market. And so it is an issue, and $50 is $50.
That's from me, yes. Thank you so much for your time.
Clem,
you have one more?
Right? I just wanted to thank you for coming on. Often, I at least have heard from the students about the price of textbooks. It's really nice to actually have a faculty person come describe what it's like to, you know, having to be making the decisions, not have information. It's helpful for me to hear how difficult it would be for you to see a price so you could factor that in. And in someone's busy day in your role, I could see how after
25 minutes, you just give up, say, well, it looks good, I guess I'll take it. And then you hear about it from your students, obviously, later. But it's nice to have this perspective in front of the committee.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Go and teach well, please. Senator Warner, would you care to comment on the bill you sent over to us and the Dash 5 amendments, if you had a chance to look at them?
Think they have logic around?
It's very skewed logic. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure following Mr. Perlman. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I thought I would come over and just give you a little history about what happened to this bill in the Senate. We had a little fun with it. We had a minority report. And the reason we had a minority report is because the textbook publishers didn't play ball early enough, and they didn't feel like they were getting the bill that they wanted. So they came in at the last minute, and Senator Morse and Senator Cruz decided to use their version as the minority report, and it was turned back. We debated ad nauseum. I'll give you, if you're a freshman, there's a freshman. I spotted him. We debated ad nauseum for probably at least an hour on whereas clauses, and let me alert you that whereas clauses are not part of the statute unless they're below a certain line. So these whereas clauses in the A. and Gross version, we just talked about them till we couldn't shut up anymore, you know, and none of them were going in the statute. Even when I indicated in my opening floor speech that they were all going to be stripped from the bill, we continued to debate them. So you can learn something from the Senate, Representative Quinn. There are other states that do have this legislation already that are bigger than us, California, Illinois. Washington State passed a disclosure bill last month. New York did this year as well. Connecticut passed a disclosure bill. Minnesota, a disclosure bill has passed one chamber. And Massachusetts will be up for a vote in their legislature this year. The GAO, Government Accounting Office, and Congress have and are currently investigating the issues of textbooks. And a federal hearing was actually held here in Portland. Well, see, Oregon is on the map. We're an important place. A federal hearing was held in Portland last month, and students were commended for their efforts here in Oregon to pass this kind of legislation. The students will give you all kinds of details about and statistics about how it's driven up the cost of their education. My daughter is a master's student in international studies at the University of San Diego, though she got her undergraduate degree at the U of O. And she called me last week in a panic because one book was $200 for one class. That's a lot of money. And I've always threatened to go up in my attic, Mr. Chair. I kept, this is how organized I am. I still have all my receipts and from all the books that I bought when I was a student. And I graduated in 1978. So I have little sheets for every term about how much I spent on books because we had to carefully allocate what we were going to spend the money on because we knew we would be eating macaroni and cheese and rice, or we might get a piece of meat. At that time, I was eating more meat than I do today. But those were decisions we had to make then. And you know what? They're still, these students are still making them now, only I think they eat ramen instead of mac and cheese. We threw hot dogs in there for gourmet dinner. But I have all my my sheets from how much my books were in there. It was a lot then. It's still a lot now. It hasn't changed. Though what has changed is the bundling technique, and that has really driven up the cost. Also, the editions of the books are moving over pretty frequently, and that's why this bill is important, because it tells you, the publisher's going to have to tell you how frequently you roll those editions over. So if you're in the second year as a professor, you know where you're at in terms of making your students buy that book or ordering that book, and it's already going to be obsolete. Walker,
I don't have the receipts, but I just got rid of the books last month. I'm sure you finally made me.
Well, you know, I still have some of my books. I kept some of them, but I resold a lot of them so that I'd have money to buy the next ones, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick. So we all have our stories from college, but it's just worse today because there is less and less money that we're giving students to assist them in college. I went to school for 4 years at the University of Oregon and came out owing nothing, absolutely nothing, and nobody paid for it except scholarships, grants, and aid, and work study. I did all those things, and that's why I love the Oregon Need Grant. We've talked about that, Representative Clem and I. I would have never gone to college without it. It's now the Opportunity Grant. But, you know, we have to do something. This is something we can do, and as more and more states do it, we can become very effective. And it was funny when I asked the representative from the Publishers Association, why didn't you come out here sooner? And his answer was, well, I didn't think he would pass something. It would be unconstitutional. So we had this earlier discussion about whether it was even constitutional to pass such a measure. We got an opinion from Legislative Council, which should be in your file, that said it is quite constitutional to do that. If you do not have that, Mr. Olson, we can provide that to you.
That would be helpful.
Ms. Hunt drafted that opinion, and we got that early on. So they were on notice, and I think the students have done a great job with working with the publishers. I understood from talking to Mr. Rowlett a minute ago, they're about 95% there, but at this point, I think we've moved as far as we're going to move, and this bill with the amendments looks pretty darn good.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions, Representative Clem?
Well, I just wanted to say how pleased I am to see the bill, and obviously I'll hear about all the contents in the later testimony, but in 2004, when I was on the Student Assistance Commission, we traveled around the state to hear just sort of general comments from the higher education world about the budget, and the two things that came up over and over and over, public, private, anywhere, were we want to see part-time students in the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and you've got to do something about textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 2005, the legislature did change the amount of funding available to do part-times, and I was waiting to see when that textbook part of it might come in, and this is it. So thank you, Senator Morissette, as well for me, and I'll look forward to kind of listening to each of the provisions. But this has been big, real big, for a while.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Clem, I agree with you. It has been a huge issue. I mean, even when I was a student, I took this history class, and I don't know where the professor is now, so I have to be careful, but I took two terms of English history from him, and I was getting really bored with his teaching style, so I thought I'd trade and sign up for another class. And when I got the list of books, there were 8 books I had to buy for the new class, and the other guy was only 1 book, so I went back and turned on the faucet, the tears, saying, I can't afford 8 books. Can I come back to your class? And he said, well, why'd you leave in the first place? And I just said, well, I just wanted to try another approach. But it was, you're kind of a boring teacher. But I had to go back to that class because I couldn't afford to buy 8 books. And those students are having to make choices like that about what if they're going to pay the bills. And then you've got the whole matter of resource fees added on top of the textbook prices. You will not see that bill this session because we've worked out a compromise with that, and I'll make sure you get a copy of that. And that's not up for hearing, so I probably shouldn't have slipped that in, but I did.
Thank you. I think, Senator. Any further questions?
All right.
Hearing none, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate
you, Mr.
being
Chair.
With us today. I'm going to go ahead and temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 365 and bring us all the way back to where we started, to start the hearing today, just with a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 462A. And, Ms. Wilson, you have a number of people who have traveled to testify on this bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, just a reminder for committee members who might have missed the opening. This is requires the Superintendent of Public Instruction to issue a fact-finding report on the division of the South Umpqua School District, number 19, into 2 districts. I'll call them up in groups of 3. Frank Brott, Carol Malmay, and Esther Eich.
Good afternoon and welcome. If you'd be so kind to identify yourself and let us know your thoughts on this bill, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. Chair Buckley, members of the Education Committee, my name is Frank Brott. I have lived in Canyonville for 42 years. 38 of those years, I was employed by South Umpqua School District as a junior high teacher for 17 years, a building administrator for 7, and the last 14 as curriculum director. I'm here today as a member of the Canyonville Schools Committee, basically asking you to move House Bill 46 or Senate Bill 462. During the hearings before Senator Walker's committee, one of the allusions that was made about the situation is that it's a marriage gone bad, and that's our perception of where we are. And there is no recourse for resolving the problems. They've gone beyond, let's sit down and talk about. I believe that ultimately the only solution is separation, although that is not the content of the bill. But in looking at two of the primary issues, one being the financial part, Representative Morgan back in February asked us to develop some financial estimates, and we did so. You have a copy of those, and that is what they are, as an estimate. I'm sure that there are overestimates, underestimates, omissions. It was a best faith effort to try to deal with Representative Morgan's request. We believe that ultimately Canyonville can sustain a separate school district. The second question, that big question that's arisen, is facilities. All of the facilities that housed Canyonville's 1 through 12 system prior to consolidation are still there. We have, depending on how you count buildings, 6 buildings over 40,000 square feet of space. We believe that we have the capability to house a K-12 system in the facilities that we have. I think the best hope that we see is that passage of this bill would allow us to move forward with a Canyonville school system that reflects our goals and needs, and Myrtle Creek moving forward with theirs.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Welcome.
Carol Malmay, Canyonville, Oregon. I've lived there for 30 years. And I won't repeat some of the things Senator Cruz described fairly well. I will say that if we get separated, there are 60 schools in the state that are smaller than we would be. I put pictures in your packets of some of our buildings to kind of give you an idea that they are decent buildings. They're not new by any means, but they are decent buildings, and that we feel like we can house our schools. We have fought off threats to close our schools for 25 years with other boards besides this one. We've come out in numbers. We're getting pretty tired of fighting the issue. This time we went out to fight the issue again, and the board stuck to their guns and did close our schools. Over 70 children went to a neighboring charter school. Some other ones went to another neighboring charter school. The one that took most of our children ran out of room and had to give a few students online homeschooling. So they put us in quite a predicament as far as where our families can go to school right now. They boarded up our elementary school and moved our junior high students to moved our elementary school students to where the junior high was. We asked them to wait before they closed our schools because it's put quite a stress on all our children and their parents. And they claimed they would save $200,000 by closing Canyonville when they actually lost over $500,000 from the loss of students. We want to control our own schools and our own money for the welfare of our children and citizens. We've talked to administrators of neighboring districts. We feel that we can share some services with neighboring districts. There's other small districts that are also having some problems. We realize that it won't be easy, but we feel like we can accomplish this. Canyonville acquired our school property. We've had schools since the 1860s. We've acquired our own property and built all the buildings we have before we joined the district. We feel it's unconscionable that the people in another city can decide to sell off our buildings and take them away from us. We feel like that's stealing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hello, my name is Esther Ike, and I'll be presenting a statement written by Bob Deaton. Thank you for accepting us here, Chair Buckley. And as this reads, sounds kind of funny at first, it says, I'm Bob Deaton. I live at 561. Oh, by the way, I lived in Canyonville for 35 years. My daughter graduated from South Umpqua High School in 87, and I absolutely love Canyonville and with its schools and the kids in our own little area. So let me continue. I was a member of the South Umpqua School Board from 1998 to 93. I ran for the board to help keep our schools in Canyonville. For the past 35 years, various school boards have threatened to close Canyonville schools and move our children to Myrtle Creek. Canyonville has always fought off by coming to the meetings in numbers and letting them know it was not an option. This was the main issues while I served on the board, and it is again met with opposition from Canyonville. At that time, the board made the decision to never bring it up again, as no amount of savings could ever justify the disruption and division between the districts. Canyonville is not a suburb of, nor does it border Myrtle Creek. They are two separate incorporated cities. Approximately 2 years ago, the threat to close our schools started again. This time, our numbers and attempts to find other solutions accomplished nothing. The board was determined to go forward with their plan. In the summer of 06, buildings were boarded up and plans moved forward to close the junior high. In the fall, the junior high students were expected to go to Myrtle Creek, but most of their parents decided to send them to neighboring charter schools. This was a very hard decision to do, by the way. This was extremely stressful for everyone in our town, and there's four or five generations of families living in this community. The current school board and administration of South Umpqua School District have adopted policies that led to students leaving the district. I believe I read that already. Mm-hmm. There has been no effort made to bring these children back by the school board, and we are always outvoted. We have two school board members from Canyonville, and there's always an outvote. There's been 25 years of wasted time due to this outvote also. On the same issues, 25 years of wasted tax dollars. Just think of all of the staff time spent on these issues just over these years. It's ridiculous. 25 years of engineering and architectural fees, which are very expensive, paid for plans never utilized, never used. 25 years of arguing, continual arguing. Oh, with anger and fighting. These two communities, there's a lot of families living together in one community and the next, and this has gone on too long. It's time to stop this waste. It's time for a separation, and let us get on with our lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from members? Representative Rilbaugh.
How long have you been South Umpqua School District? Has that been the 25
Since
years?
Since 64.
Okay, that was when they all consolidated. And
follow up.
If Canyonville were its own school district, how many students would there be
K-12? 320. Approximately 320.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Representative. I have a question just for the three of you. Anyone can answer it. The approach this bill takes, are you comfortable with this approach in terms of doing a study to see how it might be moved forward to a decision?
I think, from my perspective, having a process that is maybe a little bit less emotional has its advantages. The downside would be if, at the end of this whole thing, if somebody says, sorry, no go, and we are back where we are right now.
Understandable. Thank you so much for being here with us this afternoon, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson.
We have another panel of three from the Canyonville School Committee, Alberta Pritchett, Gloria McGinnis, and Gwen Deaton, I believe.
Good afternoon. You can go ahead and start off while your comrades are getting ready there.
Subsidizing them.
Yes, you are.
Chairman Buckley, members of the committee. I'm Alberta Pritchett from Canyonville, Oregon, and I'm with the Canyonville School Committee in support of Senate Bill 462. Good afternoon. It's an honor to be here in person to see you speak with you about the critical situation that exists in our Canyonville schools. Thank you for this opportunity. The majority of the South Umpqua School Board are raping Canyonville schools to improve other schools in the district. Our two school board members have no voice, as they're always outvoted 5-2. We have absolutely no say about what happens in Canyonville. I've lived in Canyonville for over 50 years. I had four children, two grandchildren, both attending the schools. I presently have a granddaughter and that is a freshman in the high school. I was one of the young parents back in 1964 that voted for the consolidation of the high school only. We were assured that our other schools would never be closed. This promise was broken last year when they bused our middle school students to Myrtle Creek. This has caused negative effects on the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade students. They've lost their identity. No more Canyonville Tigers. Their school spirit has vanished from their bright eyes and tender young hearts. They have no sense of belonging, which robs them of their self-esteem. They're unable to participate in after-school activities, as there's no ride home afterwards, and 10 miles is too far to walk. The bus rides to and from school are much longer. The participation in the classroom is limited because of the larger classes, and they have to compete to play sports. And our community suffers as well. Local schools are the nucleus of community activities. No more school plays, band concerts, school awards, soccer, volleyball, baseball, basketball, or football games to attend. And these were well attended with standing room only at times. And our community support in Canyonville is totally awesome. Because of how the South Umpqua School Board has treated us, irreconcilable differences exist that cannot be fixed. The only solution is to separate Canyonville schools from the South Umpqua District. Senate Bill 462 is a step to allow this to happen. Young students are our future, and we want and deserve the right to protect them and give them the best opportunities available for them. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Buckley and members of the committee. We do appreciate your giving us this time. My name is Gloria McGinnis, and I'm representing the Canyonville School Committee. I live at 450 Reynolds Street in Canyonville, and I've lived in Canyonville for 60 years, so I'm sort of the matriarch here.
I graduated from Canyonville High School in 1949. I was a judge for almost 30 years and mayor of our town for 5 years. I moved to Canyonville in my junior year of high school. I came from a school of 3,000 students in the 10th to 12th grades. Canyonville, in one building, had 1st through 12th 200 students. Well, I thought I was going to teach them a lot. Well, they taught me. Every teacher, every student in that school knew my name. We were family. We were all part of each other. A lot of us still are, and that is really important. Any of you that live in a big town, maybe you can't relate to what I'm saying, but in a small town, again, we are family. Things really haven't changed that much. We all trust each other. We've lost our trust with the school board. And as Bert said, it's something that they're just not going to get back with this board. Canyonville actually is 1 year older than the state of Oregon. We're going to celebrate our 150th in 2008. Our children were always so important to us that Canyonville formed one of the first schools in Douglas County and the state of Oregon. It is the heart of our community, and what we're asking you, please, don't allow a school board to break the faith and take our children and our schools from our town. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Yes, Gloria is a hard act to follow. My name is Gwen Deaton. I live at 487 Lugray Drive, which is located about 2.5 miles northeast of Canyonville. I've lived there for over 50 years. In fact, I came to Canyonville 1 year later than Gloria.
We
graduated the same. So I graduated in 1949 also. I went to work. My very first job was secretary at the high school for the superintendent for school district number 8, Canyonville School District number 8. I was their first paid secretary. Later, I served as clerk of Canyonville School District number 8, and I held that position for 5 years until the consolidation with Myrtle Creek. After raising my 5 children, I became deputy city recorder and then city recorder for the city of Canyonville, and I retired from there after working 20 years for the city. I'm 75 years of age, but still work because I love to work. I'm a self-employed accountant and licensed tax consultant working from my home. I'm also a volunteer treasurer for 2 nonprofit organizations, so I remain very interested and active in the Canyonville community. So I'll read from my letter that I have addressed to Representative Buckley. My husband and I both graduated from Canyonville High School and have lived in the district for over 50 years. We raised 5 children who went to both Canyonville and Myrtle Creek schools and graduated from South Umpqua High School. We also have grandchildren who graduated from South Umpqua. So you can understand that our entire family is very interested in the schools, which are so vital to the respective communities of Canyonville and Myrtle Creek. In 1964, I had held the position of clerk of Canyonville School District number 8 for 5 years. This meant that I wrote the minutes of the school board meetings, received and dispersed the monies, and did the budget work for the district. At the time that the question of consolidation with Myrtle Creek District number 19 was explored, I was present at all the District number 8 board meetings. I can tell you that there was a verbal agreement by the Myrtle Creek School Board that if the voters approved the consolidation so that a new high school could be built centrally to serve both the communities, that both Canyonville and Myrtle Creek would each retain their schools from kindergarten through 8th grade. I don't recall if this was ever put to paper other than in the minutes, but it was certainly presented to the voters of both districts as a selling point for the consolidation election. It is very interesting that the present school board says there is no record of such an agreement, and if there was, that they don't feel that future boards were beholden to honor such a promise. The record does show that Canyonville voters voted overwhelmingly for consolidation. Without Canyonville's interest in the expanded curriculum that a larger high school could offer,
The consolidation and resulting bond levy for the new high school would not have happened. And at this point, I want to tell you something that I don't have in the letter. I want to tell you that at the time of consolidation, the Canyonville School District Number 8 was very financially solvent. We were very stable. The only reason Canyonville wanted to consolidate was because they felt a larger high school would offer this expanded curriculum and better prepare those students that would be going to college. Seems like I can never be concise. I have to go on forever. Canyonville has been threatened with closure of its middle school several times over the years. The public outcry beat back the proposals until this past 2 years. Without any publicity, the Canyonville Elementary School was boarded up, modifications to the middle school in order to accommodate the elementary students began. Canyonville people were astonished that the board would remove the elementary children from the safer environment of a residential area to the middle school site on Main Street with all the attendant traffic and the money spent to work over the middle school to accommodate elementary youngsters could have been better spent elsewhere. Arrangements were made to bus the Canyonville Middle School students to Myrtle Creek's already overcrowded Coffinberry School beginning in the 2006-07 school year. Despite requests by Canyonville citizens that the board rescind their decision or explore other options, they were rebuffed time and time again. This led to the formation of the Canyonville School Committee, whose members are working diligently to save our community schools. I think it is very sad when these people on the school board who were elected to serve all the people of the district will not compromise or work with concerned people of the district, such as the Canyonville School Committee. I am very proud of these citizens of Canyonville who have come together to work towards retaining a middle school for Canyonville. They have been diligent in attending the school board meetings and presenting a very courteous, intelligent, and reasonable approach to the matter. They proposed a charter school, but were rebuffed. It seems that this present school board does not realize what bad decisions have been made. You would think that when 70 of Canyonville's middle schoolers opted to go to the charter school in Days Creek instead of Coffinberry in Myrtle Creek, they would realize how the Canyonville parents feel about their actions. You would think that the failure by a wide margin of the bond levy for a new consolidated middle school would also send a loud and clear message. Sad to say, there has been no softening of attitude or offerings of compromise. The actions of the majority of the South Umpqua School District No. 19 School Board left the Canyonville School Committee with only one option, to seek separation from the district so that a K-12 school can be established in Canyonville. We need your help. Please allow Senate Bill 462 to be introduced to the House of Representatives, and thank you for holding this hearing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you have any questions of the panel before I turn? Seeing none, just thank you so much. Your love for your community is impressive and delightful to hear. Thank you so much. Is there anyone else who is here to testify on this bill, Mr. Rolson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have one more person, Chris Davidson from the South Umpqua School District.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Davidson, welcome.
Thank you much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chris Davidson. I'm the Director of Fiscal Services for the school district. I'm here today representing the district with regards to Senate Bill 462. As you've already heard, we are a unique district in the fact that we are comprised of three distinct communities, two incorporated cities of Myrtle Creek and Canyonville, and an unincorporated area which kind of falls within Myrtle Creek's jurisdiction of Tri-City. These three distinct areas do comprise our entire school district. As you heard also, about 44 years ago, there was the consolidation into a single school district when each of these communities had theirs before. During this time, relations have for more or less been cordial with regards to the running of the school in the interest of the children. However, things kind of took a turn during the 06-07 budget sessions when we had to make some decisions when we were faced with a $400,000 budget shortfall. We explored numerous possibilities, looking at the cost savings of all of them and the minimal disruptions to affecting classrooms. The choice that ended up making the most sense was consolidation of middle schools. It eliminated duplicate programs, kept us from having actually to remove aides from classes or cut teachers or things of that nature. So that was the choice the board took and moved forward with. Unfortunately, as you've seen, it has caused quite the rift amongst the communities and a bit of an uproar. The board has made offers to do things to eliminate this rift. We have offered to help with a charter school. We were rebuffed on that. We've offered to bring back sixth grade. We have received minimal response with that. So, you know, we're kind of at an impasse at this point. The board has decided that they will not stand in the way of this Senate bill. They will not oppose it. They will stand back and let an independent third party make their decision on how best to proceed. And if the independent third party agrees that a separation of districts is the best way to proceed, then the board will follow through and follow that decision. That's the long and the short of what I have. Based on everything you've heard today, you may have some questions. I'll be happy to answer what I can.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Any questions? Representative Rildon.
Yeah, just a short one. Before the RIF and all that kind of stuff, was your district as a whole losing or gaining or holding on students?
We have been steadily declining. We've lost over 200 students in the last 5 years. That's just student bodies. That doesn't include the weightings and stuff. So,
out of a school district, what size?
We are currently today 1,710.
All right. Thank you very much.
So we were in about 1,930 5 years ago.
Did you have a question?
Just, thank you, Chair Buckley. My only comment, it's not necessarily a question, but I have worked at the high school level and the middle school level, and my only comment would be that if you looked at the research about how upsetting that is for a middle school student and students of that age, I was astounded at the shocking difference between the emotional needs of the middle school kids from the high school kids. But that's a rhetorical question. I really don't expect an answer. But
well, I'll just tell you that no budget cut's an easy budget cut. I mean,
well, I completely understand that being an administrator, but yeah, tough decisions.
Thank you. Mr. Jason, thank you so much. I know you're in a hard position. I appreciate you being here today to offer your testimony. Representative Lim, did you have a question?
Yes, I have one question. In your testimony, you mentioned the third-party study, what that means.
That's the study that's in the Senate bill where the independent party from the ODE will come and do a fact-finding.
Okay, that's what you mean.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Lim. Is that the end of the...
I believe that is. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on this bill? We are through a testimony. We are in a work session.
We are in a work session.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
Vice Chair Dahl.
Thank you, Chair. I move Senate Bill 462A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Dahl has moved Senate Bill 462A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Senator Rubin.
No. I just want to say that, you know, I will support this bill because I think we need to go on and do that, but... You know, I want to clearly explain to people that what you're seeing here is the result of federal government choice, and they're dealing with timber harvest, ballot measures 5, 47, and 50, and declining enrollment. And, you know, these groups got along in the 1960s because there was a harvest going on in the area, and our rural areas were contributing to the state in education. There was more money coming out of that went to help everybody in the state, and everybody in the state appreciated that when the money was coming and that happened. And then a public policy was made by the federal government to not do that. We lost those things, and we lost the people that went with that. And so I understand the agreements that were made, because in my district in Coos Bay, we had 11 schools that we no longer have that have closed over that period of time for much the same reasons. The problem is that right now, instead of being contributors to the state education pot, we are all the sucking sound from all the rest of the state. And we don't like that. We hate it. But the reality is, we were just looking at the numbers here. In this district, about 20% of their state, or the revenue for their schools, comes from their property taxes. I mean, that's what they get. It used to be when you took property and harvest taxes, it paid for over 100% of the schools, and they did very, very well. In my district, it's the same way. You know, if it weren't for Portland and Bend and Hillsboro, we wouldn't have the money we have now to fund our schools that we have. So, you know, I think people forget that because of these things that have happened, we've rearranged the structure of how districts get the money. So the poor school district that's down there trying to make it go has to do with what they're getting, and they're getting most of their money from out of their communities now to fund their schools. And we are appreciative of that. We wish we wouldn't have to be. We wish the policies were different, because you wouldn't see the problem happening here if the federal government had not made the policy to stop doing the harvest, because we'd have growing communities and we'd have the money that was becoming from those harvest tax, and all of these schools would be vibrant and working. And sadly, we don't, and we're declining, and it's just killing us. So that was just a comment on the whole situation.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate that. Representative Dahl and Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. I have only one. This decision is almost impossible to make. As a superintendent of Beyond Call, I faced that decision. We looked at consolidating with Drain. Very distasteful thought. But I think what you see is people that have struggled mightily.
Yeah.
And I say to Secretary, or to the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Susan Castillo, skin this one, because we're going to bring you some more.
That's true.
This is a tough issue that is not going to go away in rural Oregon. We're just beginning to see the tip of the iceberg.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Klum.
Thank you. Actually, first I had a question for Representative Roblin.
Please.
Millicoma closed, didn't it?
Millicoma is now a 5-6 school. So all the kids in the district go there, 5 and 6, and all the 7-8s go to another school. So we used to have two middle schools. We now have one and an intermediate school.
So I want to second his comments. You know, that Millicoma, which used to be the Millicoma Mustangs, Fighting Mustangs, Proud Middle School, now you got people going 35 miles probably to get to Sunset, which was our arch rival, and now that's where they're going to school. So I understand exactly what he's talking about in terms of declining enrollment. The reason I'm going to support this, though, in terms of it being a, you know, getting a third neutral party involved, because this issue is going on in other places, it sounds like. So what's unique about this? And I really don't like it when political people sort of jump on other situations, but I got to tell you that this email that luckily the person has been scolded by her school board for is appalling behavior by a public official. Trying to campaign for her own school board members using the state email system, this really calls for a neutral third party, because it is unbelievable to me. You know, I've got a huge bill file, and again, I'm sure it was heat of the moment, and I'm sure this person regrets it now, but this is a disaster, and having some third party involved is, I'm sure, the best thing that can be done, and I'm thankful to the school district for not opposing the bill. I would have voted for it anyway, but it's difficult. You probably don't know what I'm talking about. Maybe you don't even want to, but to be honest.
Right.
I do appreciate the comments, Representative Green.
Do we have any testimony from the other half of the school district?
We just had the from Mr. Davidson.
Okay.
With no further discussion, Andy, would you be so kind as to call the roll?
Representative
Clem?
Aye.
Representative
Dahl?
Aye.
Representative
Greenlick?
Aye.
Representative Hall?
Aye.
Representative
Crumble?
Excused. Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative
Woodland? Aye.
Aye. The motion carries. We'll ask Representative Morgan if she'd like to carry this bill on the House floor. Thanks to everyone who traveled here today to testify on behalf of this bill. Best of luck to the people of Canyonville. With that, we will close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 462A, and we'll open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 951A. And Mr. Olson, just remind us briefly of where we are on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For members who might have missed the initial part, Senate Bill 951 directs community colleges and state institutions of higher education to adopt plans to encourage students to register to vote and to vote in elections. And we have one witness in addition to Secretary of State Bradbury, who earlier testified on behalf of the bill, and that witness is Mike Filippelli from the University of Oregon, if I pronounce his name right.
Actually, very good.
Welcome, Mr. Filippelli. Good to have you with us. Please identify yourself and let us know what your thoughts are on this bill.
I can't vote against.
All right. My name is Mike Filippelli. I'm a student at the University of Oregon. My address is 630 East 14th Avenue, Apartment 1, Eugene, Oregon, 97401. Chair Buckley, members of the committee, in the interest of time, I know you guys have a tight schedule. I'm just going to leave you with my written testimony and just briefly summarize it. I've been involved in numerous voter registration drives at U of O through our student government, and being that I'm in the enviable position of following up on our Secretary of State, I will disagree with much of what he said. There are some barriers, through the administration and with certain policies between us and, you know, us being as effective as we could be through our voter registration efforts. And I think it's a very positive bill, and we could move forward with some of these if we implemented some changes. The example I cite here is the University of California, Santa Barbara, in which they registered 6,000 students in one day. And so if we got some of this compliance with administration, I think we could have similar efforts here. And so I'm open to any questions you have.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this witness?
Just one.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. There was a question asked by Representative Clem earlier to the Secretary of State Bradbury. Have you considered doing a petition to your county clerks to have a drop box or anything like that?
Well, I think the idea here is this is a very positive bill. It's, you know, cooperation with our administration. I definitely think that's something that that both OSA and students are interested in pursuing.
Okay.
We actually, at the University of Oregon, we do have a drop box on our campus. But I know other campuses are not in the same situation. So it's definitely something we're interested in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Filippelli. Representative Rebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment that's here that requires that you also explain what kinds of things are illegal with respect to education.
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys in support of the amendment?
Representative Rebel, just to clarify, I'm trying to clarify. These are the 521. This is a -5 amendment that we're talking about, or what, the 951? Do we have an amendment to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think he's referring to the amendments that were approved on the Senate.
So
I guess it's already in here, but it's the issue. I was looking at the old one, didn't see the A. it requires the information also about, you know, illegal activities with respect to it. And I appreciate that just because I think that it's easy. And knowing when I was being active in college and people wanting local initiatives to get everybody registered, and yet I give up my right to be registered back in my home, which I could be as well as long as I'm a student. And so I'm hopeful that those will all be discussed with people, because I think the important thing is getting people to vote, and I really like that part. But recognizing that they're going to make choices as to where they live and their residence and all those kinds of things are important for them to know. And we have a lot of out-of-state people who could choose to register here and then forget that they can't go back and vote where they came from and all of those things. So, and it has a lot of other implications for students with respect to where their residence is and all of those kinds of things. So I'm just hopeful that it's all discussed at the same time, because I think at times our students, I know I was, love to be active and get involved and do those kinds of things, and we get involved in our local things, and then we give up our right to be supportive back where we came from. I just want to make sure that is there, and I was happy to see the amendments to the
Representative Roblin, Chair Buckley. I do think when we register people to vote, we always mention one specific example is Alaska. If you're from Alaska, you probably don't want to register to vote here, because then you lose your oil money. And for college students, you don't want them losing any extra money that they have coming their way. But yeah, I do think, to my knowledge, we're still supportive of that.
Okay, that's good.
Thank you very much. Representative Dollar.
You know, I think it's a decision that the college student has to weigh and decide on. There are advantages to voting at home, and there's advantages to voting at school. I think the important thing is that we make that choice available.
Right.
I will be supporting the bill. My son was a lobbyist for OSA two terms ago, and if I don't vote for this, he'll never come home.
The personal connections are when that counts. Thanks. You represent Lim.
Thank you very much. And I do appreciate this. This is a good deal, but I want to make sure in the campus, make sure it's a neutral, nonpartisan.
Right.
How can I make sure that's going to happen?
Well, I mean, Representative Lim, Chair Buckley, I mean, we, through the student government, we always train everyone, every volunteer, before we let them go out on the street, we train them. We make sure that they're not, you know, going out there for the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, or the Green Party of Oregon, that they're going out there as a nonpartisan voter registration effort, that we're not out there with an agenda, we're out there to get students voting. And so I don't see how that would be any different with administration support, and I don't see any reason why we would ever change that.
Okay. Additional questions?
Representative Lim.
Well, I'm not talking about just volunteers. I want to make sure when you have a group of people, it's balanced, Democrat and Republican and independent, well, whatever. You know, if you take all the volunteers, maybe all volunteers could be 90% Republican. It could be 90% of a Democrat. You know, I want to make sure that this is going to be a balanced approach. That's one concern. And the second concern I might have, this the institution of higher education is the place to learn. I don't want the higher education turn into the political activity. You know, that make sure, you know, we continue on the academic pursuit, but at the same time, you know, politically neutral, and I don't want that institution to be a political crisis.
Representative Blum, Chair Buckley, as a political science major, I can say that I do believe that we always operate in a nonpartisan way, but also that when we're going to our institutions, I do think that our nonpartisan voter registration drive, if nothing else, it does teach people to be good citizens, and that when you're part of this democracy, you know, you have the opportunity and the privilege of voting, and you should take advantage of it. And so we try and encourage people to do that in a nonpartisan fashion, of course.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Vice Chair Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. And I was going to ask a question about how you decided where locations would be where people could pick up the forms, but then because you're missing a key spot that I wasn't in a lot of these places, but I was always in the library. But I wasn't in the library the first 3 weeks of the term. It was usually the last three, so so maybe your choices are very well tented. So I was going to give you a hard time about not having them in the library, but
thank you. That's a very realistic statement on your part. Representative Clem?
Actually, I can wait till we get in. We're going to be doing a work session.
Any more questions for this witness?
No.
Mr. Libby, thank you for so much for coming forward.
All right. Thank you for your time.
We are in a work session, and I would entertain a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 951A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Dahl has moved Senate Bill 951A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Clem.
Big supporter of this bill. Actually, the way I kind of got started in student activism was registering voters. And we registered 2,564 voters in the fall of 1992. We did have some difficulty getting into the residence halls at that time because there was no plan. It wasn't sort of coordinated. And so I was just trying to, at first, see if I could just go in. And they stopped me at the door and wouldn't let me go in. And then I tried talking to the advisors, and some of them would do it, and some of them wouldn't.
Should have went to the boys' residence.
Yeah. Well. And so it requires some thought on how to, you know, the at OSU there was a thing called SOAP, which was a new student summer week. That would have been a good time. We missed out on that. So having a plan is a very good idea. You know, and to my friend here who doesn't want college campuses to be political places, I don't want a lot of things, but they are. I myself at the time, I was a Republican, and I was out, you know, just registering voters. I had no idea who they were or what they were. I was just registering voters. And now I think probably the single largest group is independents would be my guess. But I never saw any hint ever of someone trying to talk somebody into registering a certain way. So you know, and in the end, they're going to vote however they want, just like most Oregonians. They'll vote for whatever party they think the person is. But even when you're registering, I've never seen someone try and say, well, register Republican or register Democrat or register Independent. And I've been on lots and lots of voter drives. So it's a very good bill. Having a plan that guarantees some neutrality and rights and responsibilities is very positive, and I'm very, very proud to vote for this bill today.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lim.
How did you come into the Democrats?
Got educated.
Moving right along. Yeah. Either,
perhaps you could move into your second childhood and go back.
Thank you.
Lesson done.
Representative Roland.
I just want to say that I appreciate the our testifier few minutes ago, because I there are some financial reasons and others about why people should stay registered in other states and those kinds of things. And I just want to make sure that all those things come out, because kids are making difficult decisions. They're coming and doing different kinds of things, and all of that needs to be taken into account. I would encourage them, if they do that, that they also tell them to go online in their other state and make sure they get registered back in their own state. But I mean, I think the idea of registration is really important, and where you register maybe is as important sometimes. But having the discussion is a great thing, and I appreciate the knowledge that they have of those issues.
Thank you, Representative.
I'd like to make one more comment.
Representative Lim.
I want to make sure, Chair, that the registration is one thing,
mm-hmm.
and voting is another.
Mm-hmm.
And then since they are moving maybe quarterly every time, it's very hard to keep track of their address. And then after registering, and it's vote by mail. You know, it simply takes 5 to 10 minutes to do that. I hope they do vote, you know, because each vote is count. That's very important.
Thank you, Representative. Without further discussion, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Clem. Aye.
Representative
Dahl.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. The motion carries. Representative Clem, would you be so kind as to carry this bill on the floor for us?
Gladly.
With that, I'll close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 951A and open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 365. Mr. Olson, can you remind us where we are on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For those of you who might have missed the initial, we had a testimony from Senator Walker, one of the bill's chief sponsors, as well as Mark Perlman, a Western Oregon University professor. The bill requires college textbook publishers to provide prospective adopters of a particular textbook or set of textbooks with specified information regarding products. You have before you the A5 amendments. We have a couple of people to testify in general, and then we also have a couple who could speak to the amendments. So I'll start out, if it's all right, Mr. Chair, with the Please. Students who want to testify. Zach Wilmarth and Hannah Fisher, excuse me. And Mr. Brett Lorette, I think, might, did you want to introduce them, or you want to come up later?
Welcome, good to see you.
Good to see you, Chair Buckley. Representatives, for the record, my name is Hannah Fisher, and my address is 2136 Northwest Johnson Street. I'm going to be submitting written testimony. In the interest of time, I will just speedily go through my story. I am one of those clever students that attempts to circumvent the cost of textbooks by ordering them online through Amazon.com. Winter term of this year, I attempted to do that, but my book did not arrive in time, and I left for Washington, D.C. for National Student Lobby Day without having received my book. I returned back on the 9th of March, and I had a paper due on the 10th. I had to borrow the book, read it, and write the paper in one night. Luckily, I got a B+, but it was an incredibly trying experience, and this has happened actually again this term. I couldn't buy both books for one class at the beginning of the term, went back after my midterm, tried to buy the second book, and the book was no longer in the library and isn't on Amazon.com anymore. So I strongly urge you to support Senate Bill 365. It's your job as legislators to try to eliminate all roadblocks to higher education, and supporting this bill would create the clearest path. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
For the record, my name is Zach Wilmarth. I live at 215 Northwest 21st, Corvallis, Oregon. Chair Buckley and members of the committee, I'm a student at Oregon State University, and I'm here to testify in support of the Senate bill. Now, I've had one teacher in this year of college that has actually known the monetary value of the book. She only cost me $50 for a book and a workbook, luckily. Now, the rest of my teachers, my chemistry teacher, cost me $115 used and never mentioned the book once in class, and we still haven't been required at all to use the book at all. Now, my psychology teacher cost me $106 brand new, and this is all in one term, mind you, because that book just came out with a new edition, and we were responsible for that edition. But he happily provided us with two additional supplemental chapters that the company gave them for free. So that was awesome experience. Now, last term, textbooks cost me almost $400, and most of that is because they came bundled with CDs already. I've yet to use one CD for any of my classes, and that's not because I've been too lazy to use the CDs, or it's actually because that in lecture and with my textbook, I've gotten all the material that I've needed. I have not used the CD because I haven't needed to for any of my classes. Now, at the end of the term, I go in and scramble to find all these CDs that came with the books because the bookstore doesn't buy them back unless you have the CDs with them. Now, after paying for college, students shouldn't have to worry about paying for these expensive textbooks because of all these add-ons that come with them. Please help make college a little bit more affordable and allow instructors to select those textbooks and workbooks or CDs that they actually need for the classes and not just, you know, a textbook, a workbook, and a CD that I'm only going to use one of. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions for these students? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, what is it?
I forgot your name. Apologize.
Zach Wilmer.
Hi, Zach. The situation you described to us about the professor ordering or requiring you to order the textbook you never used, this bill doesn't address that, does it?
No, it doesn't.
But we can call him if you'd like.
He's a beaver.
Thank you so much for your time and being here today to testify.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Wilson?
Chair Brett Roulette and Laura Etherton.
Should we amend the bill to do that?
Go after that.
Sounds good.
Welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brett Roulette, Legislative Director with the Oregon Student Association. I'm not going to give my address because I'm embarrassed to live in Tualatin. Oops. I'm just kidding. I know the mayor's probably watching on TV. But I briefly wanted to go over the amendments with you today that we passed out, the 365-A5 amendments. These are amendments since our bill originally came up in the Senate. As Senator Walker had mentioned, the textbook companies came out right before the deadline to move bills out of the Senate side. And so we scrambled. We were able to compromise on a couple things, but the version that passed out of the Senate Education Committee was not the finished version that either side, the publishers or us, hoped to see pass. And that what you have before you today is the result of some ongoing negotiations that we've had with the publishers since the bill moved out, and working in conjunction with Osberg, Laura here, we feel that what you have before you today is a very good version of the bill. It is in the best interest of students and faculty, and we also feel that it respects the rights of the publishers. Now, as Zach had mentioned earlier, the purpose of the bill is not to instruct professors what books to buy. The purpose of the bill, there's two purposes. The first is to give all the instructors the information that they need to make the best possible decisions for their classes. If they don't need certain materials, let them know that so that they don't require students to buy accessories to the classes that will just increase the cost of their attendance. That will, in turn, save students money and make college more affordable. At the same time, we also wanted to address the issue of bundling, which this does. As the students have kind of testified, often books will come bundled with materials. We just want to give instructors more options for what they
choose to have students buy for their classes. If certain things aren't necessary, then students won't have to buy those. If you bear with me, I'll briefly go through the amendments that are before you to kind of explain the changes that we made from the version of the bill that passed out of the Senate. At the bottom of page one, we revised the version or the definition of what textbook bundle is. We basically wanted to update this so that it would include some of the changes from when we were writing the bill. We were thinking traditionally, I think as Laura and I went through school, nowadays there are more online supplementary materials that are included, and so we included that with the definition. On page two, when we look at the definition of what textbook bundle does not include, we expanded that. We, through talking with the textbook companies, realized that there were, in times, materials that the publishers had to provide to the education institutions bundled. If you were providing a book to your computer technology classes, let's say an Adobe class on how to use Photoshop, you'll buy the software. At the same time, you may get a small book with that, and that's necessary to go together. So that's included in here, as well as the third-party contractual agreements, custom editions, and special editions. On line 8, we did our best in section 2 to limit the amount of information that would be given to an instructor. In the original version of the bill, it dealt with subject area. We wanted to, instead of, let's say, history, narrow that down to American history, and even at the same course level. So you wouldn't have to give an instructor in college-level American history what books are available in middle school, high school, and graduate programs, just basically for what that instructor is looking for. And this came from our discussions with the textbook book publishers, but also with faculty. What would they like to see available to them? And so on line 8, we included the subject area in which an instructor is teaching a course, and then also on lines 10 and 11, the subject area and level in which an instructor is teaching a course. Okay. And if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt. But lines 14 and 15, basically B and C are significant changes from the version that passed out of the Senate, but we feel it's a little bit better for instructors and for the publishers. For lines 14 and 15, it's the year in which each prior edition of the textbooks were published. The original bill had called for them to disclose their plans for coming out with new versions, but textbook companies do not always know when their new versions are going to come out. And so this will give an instructor a good idea when their next versions will come out. If a version comes out every 3 years, they'll know when to expect the new one. 16 through 19 is just rewording on the type the pricing information that's given to the faculty. So it's the pricing at which the books will be made available to students on that campus. The original bill called for the wholesale price, but that differs from school to school. Other than that, in section 2, subsection 2, we also changed line 22. The original bill said easily accessible to any member of the public. We got rid of the word easily because there would be some debate over what easily is. We just wanted to make sure the materials were accessible. And then also included on line 23, the original bill mentioned only a website. We wanted to give publishers as many options as possible when dealing with the public. And this came from the recommendation of the publishing companies to also include by telephone or postal or electronic mail. And in that section, the first sentence deals with the information given to faculty. The second sentence deals with the information that must be made accessible to the public. And then finally, in section 3, lines 26 and 27, it was just some clarifying the words that were in there to include prospective adopters. That was a minor change. But we have gone back and forth for about 3 weeks now, trying to come up with amendments that we be proud to bring before you today, and we feel like this is a very good bill and something that we ask for your support of.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the Consumer Advocate for Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. And I wanted to thank you for considering this bill to help make college textbooks more affordable, primarily by adding some good transparency and some good options, so that faculty, who we believe actually really want to help choose the best book so they can teach students the best way, but take cost into account within that decision-making process. So I think this bill has some very strong components in it. I think that it is, it's not a heavy hand. It is merely disclosure and some additional options regarding bundling or not bundling. It doesn't have strong enforcement provisions. As Representative Comp mentioned, we expect and anticipate that the publishers will abide by the letter and the spirit of Oregon law and trust that that will happen. And so I think there's a number of ways that the bill could have been exactly written or in regard to the technical changes, and I believe that Mr. Gardner from the Association of American Publishers has distributed a memo regarding some of the further changes that they would advocate. I think that there are a lot of pieces in here that we would be fine with, but in fact going through as it is, it also works just perfectly fine, and with these changes would also, you know, some of them would be fine and some of them are more policy changes on whether or not there's public disclosure of costs and so on. So I think that the bill as is what we think is something that the Oregon legislature can be very proud of. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Robles.
I just want to make sure that I got it right. If I look at the amendments and then look at the original bill, it appears that the only thing we're keeping is it enacted by the people of the state of Oregon.
Well, that's not the only thing.
No, I mean, it's all supplanted with the new wording, which does include. Is that correct? I didn't get that wrong.
Well, Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, there is some information that is kept the same.
There's some that's embedded in the new one that's the same as the old one. But
it was easier to...
Yes.
Come up with the gut and stuff amendment than it was too.
Just want to make sure that I wasn't missing anything when I said okay.
Right. Hopefully this makes it easier to read.
Yeah.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your time and your efforts on this bill. Mr. Olson.
Jim Gardner, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tim Gardner, and I am appearing today for Association of American Publishers, happily the second time this session for that particular client. With regard to the first appearance, we were able to work completely through all the details and come to a full agreement on the handicapped access bill, and we're pretty close, I'd say about this close, on about 95% of the way there on this one. We would like the opportunity to have a few more days to iron out what we view as some remaining wrinkles in the bill, and I'll just go through them quickly. They're outlined in the memorandum that I gave you. We think it's appropriate to have a freestanding definition of bookstore rather than having bookstore be deemed a subset of the category higher education institution. And the reason for that, I think our motivation is the same as that of the proponents, because regardless of whether the bookstore is owned and operated by our higher education institution, it is important to include it with as the defined element if the specific bookstore that is intended to be referred to in the definition is the principal, the primary bookstore for that institution. You know, there are higher education institutions, for instance, that have as their primary bookstores that are not owned and operated by the institution. And that's the clarifying distinction, and it seems inappropriate to kind of put it under the definition of institution. A more substantive alteration we would like to see is the definition of the exclusion of textbook bundle. The definition that's in the amendment right now says that a textbook bundle does not include a textbook that is unusable without the supplemental materials. And we would prefer language that would say textbook bundle does not include course materials that are designed solely for sale as an integrated combination of two or more units. And I'll use the example that Brett gave of the Adobe book and the software to which it really is a kind of a guide. That book might be it might not be entirely unusable without the CD. I mean, there might be some value. That's a very absolute term, but it is designed to be used as an integrated unit. And we think that's a better way technically of capturing what we're talking about rather than the kind of the nomenclature unusable. The third change is on page 2, line 18, to change adopters in higher education institutions to bookstores. And this is an important technical change because neither adopters nor higher education institutions actually resell textbooks to students. Only bookstores do that. So just to be clear about what we're talking about, the term bookstore should be there. Again, now one that is more substantive. On page 2, we'd like to see the deletion of lines 20 to 24. The substantive disclosure requirement is contained in the remainder of Section 2, and we don't think you need to micromanage that disclosure process. But if necessary, we could agree to the first sentence of subsection 2, beginning on line 20. And then on page 2, lines 26 through 27, we think that, again, you should delete the language and higher education institutions. And that's because higher education institutions, per se, do not order or adopt textbooks. That's what's done by adopters, a term we have defined. That change would then parallel the language in line 30, which is immediately below it. And finally, for somewhat similar reasons, on page 3, we would prefer to delete lines 2 and 3 and insert in their place the phrase, the separately purchased new textbook is available from the publisher. And the reason for that is, again, that higher education institutions do not purchase the textbooks. Students purchase them. And the bill is concerned with new textbooks. I do want to say that we very much have appreciated working with Osberg and the Oregon Student Association. We've very close to a consensus bill, but we'd like the opportunity to refine the language over the next few days so that we can have a work product that everyone can endorse and everyone can be proud of.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Would the representatives from OSA and Osberg please stay, Ms. Carter. Yes, thank you. I'd like to come up as well as we work this and to start off with any immediate comments on the amendments.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question of the last witness, or should I wait till after this part?
Representative, you go right ahead. We're in a work session. We'll keep it rather informal. Okay.
So you had talked about how only bookstores sell. So if we change from adopters nor higher education students to bookstores, how would that affect something like the Western Oregon University Book Exchange or the OSU Student Affairs Task Force Book Swap, which are all student-run cooperatives, not bookstores, and or sort of, you know, it's almost like a private party transaction facilitated by student government, really.
Mr. Chair, Representative Klim, I'm not familiar with those particular institutions, but may I ask a question? Are those used bookstores or used exchange facilities?
Those are used books. Yeah, they're trading and already used. Yeah,
yes, Mr. Chair, we're concerned with the disclosure and sale requirements for publishers of new books.
Of new.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative. Any comments on the amendments from Mr. Gardner's?
Sure. Let's see. Again, Laura Atherton from Osberg. Let's see, with regard to the first suggestion of changing the definition of higher education institution to not include bookstores but have that be separate, I think that would be one approach. Without doing that, however, because the primary bookstore is included in the definition
of higher education institution. It makes the other changes in this memo not necessary. The third change only books notes that only bookstores resell books to students, but because those are included in the definition of higher education institution, that's fine. That's the same case for the fifth and the sixth suggestions as well. So with the current definitions, we believe that the bookstores the current language is appropriate because of that. There are many technical ways of doing it, but we think the existing language you have is just as good. With regard to the more policy related questions, on the definition of textbook bundle, I think the concern there with the suggested language is that it is could potentially open up a large loophole defining what's designed as a solely for integration as one product. It's a pretty good definition of any bundle right now. It's clearly designed to go together because they shrink-wrapped it all together and sold it to you like that. So I think that actually would be problematic and may exempt many books that it would be appropriate for those to be available separately. And it's really the faculty member that should be the deciding factor, the adopter, the various colleges and universities should be the ones deciding what is the materials that are going to help me teach this course. And that's the critical piece. That the unusable standard is not the overarching one that all textbooks would have to meet to be exempt from this, because the word is or and not and so it would also materials that cannot be sold separately due to third party contractual agreements, custom editions or special editions would also be exempted from that, and we're fine with that. On the fourth suggestion, I think in this area, this is an area we probably just won't agree on. The students and faculty and I think in the broader public interest is college. The increasing cost of going to college is a public concern. This is an area that parents, students, families, the public at large should have the right to have basic information about the cost of textbooks, and that's, I think, just a difference of opinion there. And because it is, there's so much flexibility in how to provide that information, so should a student want to find out how much a textbook costs, that seems appropriate there. And I think that basically would be our response there. The existing bill is something that we're very comfortable with.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, I just wanted to add that the original bill that went to the Senate Education Committee did not include bookstores in the definition of higher education institution. That was brought to us by the attention of the Chancellor and also from the bookstores. And so we did work with a couple of the bookstores to come up with that definition, and we felt it important to include there. If we had another line with what the definition of a bookstore was, then you would have to define, well, was it the primary bookstore, or in the case of the University of Oregon, there is the University of Oregon bookstore, there's also Smith Family Bookstore, and there's other bookstores in town that serve as bookstores for students. So that's why, with their support, we did include it there.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? Mr. Zawisit?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Talking to both of you, I think there has been a lot of work here, but I don't know what one more meeting or trying to resolve this, because, I mean, I looked through this file with the minority report and the vote as close as it was in the Senate, and we even indicating on the staff summary sheet that we need to do more work. So, you know, if we can make it, this is our last chance, let's make it better. And I'm really serious talking to Zach. I mean, we got a problem here with the adopter. If he's ordering the students to get a textbook and the professor doesn't use it, that's more of a problem. That's a problem that needs to be addressed by separate legislation, but that should be addressed. That should be part of the OSA agenda, is the guy that's making the decisions and buys a book the professor never uses. That's ridiculous. And that should be gone after.
Chair Buckley, Representative Lisnett. That's what we hope this bill does, is by giving instructors the information they need to choose their materials, they'll look at it a little more closely. And if they realize that they can purchase the materials or assign them to students without having to do a bundle, maybe that they only are going to use the textbook and one supplemental material, that's what the students would purchase.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to this, Will? An important feature that was in the minority report that is absent from this bill, and if that's the desire of the proponents, that's fine with us. But for future reference, it's something that we need to look at, Representative Wisnan, and it responds directly to your concern. There was an ethics provision called anti-pay-to-play that was in the original in the minority report, which basically prohibited the receipt or the offer of consideration to adopters to influence them to choose particular textbooks. I think that's an emerging issue similar to the kind of problems we've seen with the student loan situation. And for the future, I'd like to hope that can come back on the table. We would have loved to seen it pass this time, but it's an important area where I think we can work together in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Representative Clem.
That last one is an excellent point. There, I forget what the term for it was. It's some sort of financial incentives that take place. Had a question on the third bullet point, 2, line 18, and that's talking about the price at which the publisher would make the textbook or set of textbooks available. I thought I heard that this wasn't necessarily one of the policy ones, but unless I'm missing something, if our goal is to have the faculty member know what the price is so they can then make a decision, isn't that where we have the faculty member be made aware in the part where it says, you know, the price at which the publisher would make the textbook or set of textbooks available to adopters in higher education institutions that would resell the components to students? If you took out bookstores, the bookstore would be made aware of the price, but I don't know that the faculty member would be aware of the price, so they wouldn't necessarily know, you know, if they're ordering up a $40 textbook or a $95 textbook.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, I think that that change is intended to precisely require a provision of that information to the prospective adopter, which is, if you look back up at line 6 and 7. But it's the price at which it would be made available to the bookstore, because that's essentially the wholesale price that we charge. So it's intended to accomplish exactly that objective. Since we don't offer, we don't make it. This gets very, you know, kind of.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. we're out of time.
I'm sorry.
And I don't mean to cut you off or upset him. We have to give the next committee the use of the hall. So what I'm going to do, we're going to carry this over to Wednesday, the Wednesday hearing. I'm going to close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 365, and we will be talking with you and working this bill on Wednesday. Mr. Olson, did you have an announcement to make?
Just briefly, in addition to the Wednesday agenda, we have 4 bills. Adding this bill for a work session, that'll bring us to 5 bills. We've just issued also committee members an agenda for a Thursday meeting, 1 o'clock. It's at this point just one bill, but just a reminder, since it's not time we usually meet, but it's to accommodate various schedules and things that we'll be meeting this Thursday, and we just issued an agenda on that. So just want to make sure everyone was aware of that.
And again, our plan is not to meet Friday afternoon to allow
Thank travel time. Is that a plan or a decision?
We'll not be meeting Friday afternoon.
That's a decision?
That is, we'll not be meeting Friday afternoon.
Good. Okay. Family will have
Thank you for your time and consideration, members. Thank you.
We're going to have Ed.
We're